The Parents Show on Mix 92.6. Sponsored by Raiden Solicitors. Award-winning specialist family lawyers. See raidensolicitors.co.uk.
Hello and welcome to The Parents Show on Mix 92.6. I'm Lydia L. Corey, and tonight I'm delighted to be joined by Max Lewis, who is a barrister, 29 Bedford Row Chambers in London. And I'm also joined by Binny Fagura, who is Associate Solicitor at Raiden Solicitor, who are, of course, very valued sponsors of The Parents Show. Thanks for joining me in the studio.
Hello, Lydia. Lovely to be back.
Hi, thank you for having us.
And welcome. First time for you, Max, in the Mix 92.6
Very
studio.
Exciting.
Well, we're delighted to have you. So it's fantastic to have Raiden Solicitors come and give their advice. But now we've got a new voice. You're actually a barrister as opposed to a solicitor. So tell us a little bit about what you do, Max, and what's the difference between a family solicitor and a family barrister?
So my job is to come in when solicitors haven't been able to sort it out between themselves and they need to go to court and have a judge decide what needs to happen, whether it's to do with money or to do with children. 90%, 95% of cases, people will be able to sort out their disputes with the help of people like Beanie. Sensible, helpful, rational advice at the beginning is great. So I won't see any of those cases. The only ones I ever see are where, even where excellent solicitors have tried really hard, there are people that want to kill each other. And those are the ones that I see.
I'm feeling the collaborative love here. It's lovely, lovely to hear, Max. And for our listeners, Beanie, tell us a bit about your role.
Exactly what Max has said. So I'm normally the first point of contact when somebody's going through a breakdown in their marriage or having difficulties discussing arrangements with their children. They will come to me and we will see them from the outset, try and advise, see if they can reach an agreement between themselves amicably. And if not, or we feel that actually there's no other route except court proceedings, that's when I would then speak to someone like Max. And a lot of the time I'd invite Max, say, to the office, or we'll go to chambers and have a meeting to discuss strategy. So we have a good, close relationship, and actually it's very beneficial for clients at the outset, even before they do make the decision to go to say, issue at court. To have advice from a specialist barrister, it's invaluable. So then it's proved invaluable in lots of cases where then they actually settle before having to make an application to court because they've got that pragmatic advice from someone such as Max.
And I suppose the first time we spoke to Raiden Solicitors, it surprised me how committed you are to resolution at the earliest possible point and not letting things get too bad, really. And I love hearing it time and again when we speak to you. And, you know, it's really, really constructive and positive. And I'm sure listeners think, great, you know, it doesn't have to be guns at dawn when you come to a divorce, that there are amicable ways to do it.
Of course. And I was recently on the show talking about the collaborative process. And it's something that I still fully endorse. And just sadly, sometimes you will have people that just aren't able to focus on that type of the collaborative process. And whilst it's beneficial to have court proceedings because you have a judge who's involved and can make a decision at a time where two people can't sadly reach an agreement.
I agree. Just two things I would add about that. If it doesn't, it's not an overly barrister way to begin a sentence. First is that once you get into court, there's still heavy pressure on you to resolve your disputes from the judges, because they know, as the barristers know, quite how destructive, expensive, unpleasant and difficult it can be. And so there is a built-in negotiation, mediation phase, even when you get through the court door. So just because proceedings start doesn't mean you're going to end up in an episode of LA Law. It means that you've now got a judge, an independent person, saying, no, really sit down and come to a deal if you can. Second thing I would say is that what a good solicitor will do for you is tell you when to fight, but also, more importantly, tell you when not to. And I think sometimes people go to a solicitor and what they think they're paying for is the most aggressive advice they can find. But that is stupid, in my opinion, and short-sighted. What I like about Raiden's and about Beanie in particular is that she will say, actually, no, you are better off sitting down around a table and trying to negotiate a deal with this. 1 in 100 might need to go all the way to a trial, and that's when I come in. But 99 out of 100, often going to court is a failure rather than progress.
I think that's so reassuring, and it's really good to hear. Thanks a million for taking the time and explaining that properly. So let me just get into a little bit more detail about the stage at which a solicitor would get involved when someone would come to a solicitor and when someone would come to a barrister. We've touched on, but maybe a little bit more detail.
So with the solicitor, I'm generally the first point of contact, and I would assist clients with the drafting process, the initial legal advice. We would try and negotiate between solicitors. And as Max quite rightly said, when that isn't going the way that your client wants it to, or the strategic discussions and negotiations are failing, that's when I would then say, actually, we need to speak to a family barrister and let's sit down and discuss this. So I would be responsible for the drafting if once I've spoken to Max, we've had a conference, Max says, this is what I think the next steps are. I would go away and draft all the documentation and then have all the documents ready for Max to present at court at the first hearing, for example. So yes, I will be responsible for that, and then Max will come in and do all the magic.
That's very kind.
Over to you, Max.
But obviously, that's true, particularly the magic bit. But it is when you are spending time with your solicitor, you build a relationship with them as a client, and you spend a lot of time with them. Mm. At a time when your world has fallen apart because there are issues over your children or there are issues over your marriage, I have a very different relationship with the client. I only come in as and when specifically needed by the solicitor. And so I don't build that, you know, I'm friendly and polite and I'll offer tea and biscuits, but I don't become close with them in the way that I think that Beanie would do.
Yes,
which allows me to be that bit more objective, but also allows Beanie to say, actually, you know what, I've got this client, I'm not quite sure, it could go this way, it could go this way, can you give me a second opinion, or just can you sense check something that I'm thinking through? And that's fine. So coming to me isn't always, oh my god, we're going to go all the way to a trial.
Yeah.
It's just, actually, I want somebody else to give me a sense of what's really going on, because I'm a little bit too close and I want someone who's a bit more objective. So that's one of the big things that I do.
And touching on that, that's really important, actually, for a solicitor and barrister to have a really good relationship, because we're working collaboratively with the client. They're our client. We've got their best interests at heart. And we do work very well together. And the client will see that. They will have that. And we work as a team. So it's that's important for...
It's also important to understand that a barrister isn't better or higher than a solicitor. I think sometimes people have this view that, you became a barrister because you were good enough, but the solicitors weren't good enough, so they didn't do it. That's not the relationship between solicitors and barristers. It's much closer to the relationship between a hospital consultant and a surgeon.
Yeah.
Right? You're both working in the same building, but you're doing very specific different things. Not every person that goes to see the hospital consultant will need to go and see the surgeon. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you go and see the surgeon and say, well, actually, no, just leave it. It'll get better on its own and fine. That's the relationship that we have. So I do something very specific as opposed to something more important or better.
And what you're saying makes a lot of sense, because if you have that, if you have that kind of collaboration, that, synergy and same approach, everything's going to run better, isn't it? Everything's going to run more smoothly with the client. And I could imagine it's incredibly reassuring for clients too.
It's huge, particularly because the solicitors and barristers are bringing different things to the same problem. The solicitor brings much more kind of a commercial sense of a day-to-day. They know the client. They understand what a client wants, what's going to count as a success for them, what's going to count as a failure for them. I bring, well, here are the risks of what happens if you go to trial. The answer might be here, it might be here, it might cost you this, it might cost you that. And so we bring a different range of sources of advice to the same client, which I think is hugely useful for them.
Yeah. And also, barristers are in court most of the time. They're before judges. They will have an idea of what the judge is likely to say or where or what direction the case is likely to. So it's good for the client to see that firsthand that's a barrister's point of view, and this is that may happen at court.
I agree, and a lot of people will, in the height of an argument with their ex-spouse, say, well, in which case, I'll see you at court. And then they come to me and I say, fine, but if you do that, this is what's going to happen.
Yeah.
So maybe you want to row back a bit.
Yeah, brilliant. And of course, because it's all about personalities, you know, and you will understand the different personalities of the different judges, and it's an important factor to take into consideration, I would imagine. So let's talk about divorce and finances. Can you tell our listeners who don't know what the divorce process looks like from start to finish, please?
So it starts with...
This is a 20-minute show.
This is a 20-minute show. maybe the top line.
Yeah, the top line. We'll go to finance. It's a divorce. Yeah. It's very simple. Now, there's either a joint application or a sole application. Either can apply. There's no fault assigned to the breakdown of the marriage. Now you simply apply. And then you have a 20-week reflective period in which you then try and resolve any finances, if there are any. And then you get to a conditional order stage. And that's important, because at that point that a court has jurisdiction or is able to make any orders regarding finances. And then following that, you have a 6-week period, and then you can formally end your marriage. But it's the 20-week period which is quite crucial, because if there are finances, and that's normally when Max will be involved, because you will get a situation where people just can't agree their finances.
So 20 weeks, it's actually a lot quicker than I thought. And when you say no fault divorce, I know, because I've learned so much from you and your colleagues at Graydon Solicitor, that no fault divorce is a relatively new introduction. Does it mean that there is never a fault, or you can choose the no fault avenue to a divorce?
Until a couple of years ago, if you wanted to get divorced, you had to justify why you were entitled to a divorce. And you had various different justifications you could use, one of which was, oh my God, my ex-spouse was behaving like a monster. Others were, we've been living apart for a long time, or they'd slept with somebody else, or whatever it is, but you had to justify it. What's happened in the last, since 2021, 22, I forget which, is that you no longer have to justify it. So if you want a divorce, you have to wait and reflect and make absolutely sure. And there are kids involved. There's stuff to do. There's money to sort out. But once you've gone through that, English law says, then you can have your divorce. But actually, people's behavior is one of the biggest hot topics at the moment in divorce, because there's still this idea that if somebody has had an affair, if somebody's behaved very badly, that they should be punished within the divorce process for that. And unless somebody's behaviour is really, really extreme, by which I mean long sustained domestic violence, I've had attempted murders, I've had poisonings, these kinds of things that I see in the more extreme cases that I do, it's very difficult for lots of people to accept that actually it's not going to make much of a difference. And they are better off hearing that before they start.
Yes.
And one of the things that I'm sure that Bina, you have to do, is to say to people at an early stage, that doesn't matter, that doesn't matter, that might matter, that doesn't matter, that doesn't matter. And that must be hard for them.
It is difficult, especially if there's been adultery, dishonesty. They want to be able, this is why my marriage broke down. And it was the no-fault-based system was introduced to try and remove that blame, so that part people that are going through the separation can start at an amicable footing, and hopefully the financial arrangements and children arrangements would flow. And but you do have the aggrieved party that wants to say, no, it was because of this. So it can be tough, but actually it's now completely irrelevant.
It is largely irrelevant. There are some, it has to be extreme, but but what happens sometimes is that people come to see their solicitor full of anger, and sometimes entirely justified anger, but they're full of it. Mm-hmm. And that anger needs to go somewhere. And it either comes out in the legal process, and effectively they end up paying my mortgage, which doesn't help them. Or a good solicitor will say, well, actually, you need, let's maybe go and see a therapist or go and get some help. And then come back to me in a couple of weeks. And then when you're a bit more settled and a bit more level about all of these things. But sometimes people can rush into litigation too quickly. And a good solicitor will stop them from doing that.
That makes so much sense. Because obviously, you like it. If you've been through a trauma of sorts, making the divorce the kind of outlet for you being de-traumatized doesn't sound like a good idea for anybody.
Absolutely.
So that's brilliant that therapy is recommended even before the process begins. So you're just focused on the goal, which is getting the divorce done.
And the big thing that I've seen in the course of I've been doing this 25 years now, but in the course of my career, what I have seen is that judges increasingly are understanding that now. Rather than just them, it's another legal dispute in front of me and I've got to decide, do I this, do I do that? They realise that actually, as barristers and as judges and solicitors, we know that at the end of the day, we close our files up and we go off and we do something else. And we're aware that the people that have been involved in this have to go home and are still carrying this stuff. And unless it's absolutely necessary to do it, nobody should be doing it.
No. Brilliant. Because we're talking about humans and we're talking about emotions at the end of the day. Now, I would like to ask you to explain what a full and frank disclosure is. What is it and why is it so important?
So that normally starts with me. And that's really how the process would start. So if two people are separating, they're trying to consider their finances, we would ask our client and ask the other spouse to complete something called a Form E, which is a document, a financial document that's required by the court, but it sets out all your assets, property, capital, income. And from that, once you've exchanged and we've had a look at it, we're able to have some settlement discussions and negotiations following that, provided it's completed correctly and the other party has provided full and frank disclosure. And there are lots of cases where they are, but there are cases where they aren't. And if there are aspects that the other party, your spouse, hasn't completed correctly and is refusing to give disclosure about that, it's at that point that we would probably suggest an application to court needs to be made so that we can get a judge and a court involved. And that's, again, when I would ask for Max's assistance in that process. But it's important, and at the outset it's important, because if you're going to have these discussions early on, you're more likely to settle without getting to a point where you're having to make an application to court, or even at a point where you are instructing a barrister. So we would always stress it's important from the outset. Max will probably add some more to that. You'll probably see a lot more in the court.
I do, but I would add one thing, which is that very often, people, particularly with older couples, but not exclusively, they may well not know what the other person's finances look like. Because in a very old-fashioned, traditional marriage, it may have been the husband that dealt with all of it, and perhaps he gave his wife an allowance in that old-fashioned way. And they get divorced, and the lawyers are saying to them, or to her perhaps, well, you know, the English law says that you can only really do a deal if everybody's walking into it with their eyes open and we know what there is and we know what the things that we've got to deal with. And they're saying, well, I've got no idea what their finances look like. So the solicitor's job is to, it's empowering them to make a decision by ensuring they've got the information they need to be able to make it. So that is what full and frank disclosure is. The idea, cards up on the table, everyone absolutely open and honest about what they've got. And some of the trickiest cases that I see are where people are hiding stuff. And that's how I legitimately pay my mortgage, is through that way.
That's it. Great. And I actually probably jumped the gun, because full and frank disclosure is the end of the financial kind of process. And there is another,
It's a means to an end. It's a means to an end.
Got it. But often not needed, I suppose, if there is transparency about the finances from the start.
Even if you want to, the basic rule is people are free to do whatever deal they want. They're grown-ups, they can agree what they want. But if they want an agreement which is binding, or which perhaps could be enforced if somebody breaks it, or you want a court order, then you can only do that if the court is satisfied that the deal is fair. And the way the court decides if it's fair is to look at what the disclosure is and say, one, are we happy that everyone's been upfront about what assets we've got? Okay, fine. If they are, then let's have a look at what this deal looks like in the context. You've got one multimillionaire over here. We've got one person with no money over here. What do you mean you're giving them £10 a month? Right? That's unfair. As opposed to, you know, you've got a house, maybe a pension, and here's how we're dividing it up. And the court will say, okay, fine. That looks fine to me. And they'll endorse it.
It's so interesting to hear you say that, to use the word fair, because again, I think there's probably a lot of myths and confusion about how you come to an agreement. I mean, I know even personally from hearing people talk about divorce, they're like, oh, no, there's a rule you have to give 50%, or, oh, there's no way you can get more that, you know, there's all sorts of urban myths out there. But I love that fair is a word that's used by the courts. It's very reassuring.
It's a word the courts have been using since about, there was a very big case that changed how we dealt with things in 2000. And everybody realized that actually, what are we trying to achieve with all of this? The law says, here are the various things that you can do, but the law doesn't say, here's what you're supposed to be trying to achieve. And they, well, actually, we need to be fair to people. And in particular, the way, and in that case in particular, it's to do with not valuing earning money more than contributing in other ways to a family. Because there is still this, there was at least then this impression that somehow caring for children, giving up a career, wasn't as valuable as going out and working for a living. And a bunch of very old men in the House of Lords, as it was then, said, no, actually, they are the same. They are equally as valuable. And that is why fairness has become the touchstone of everything that we're doing in all of this. But in fact, that's not the only myth. There's one bigger myth than that, if I may say so, which is the myth, and we're going a long way outside what we're talking about, but the myth that the common law marriage, that if you're living together for a very long time and you don't have that piece of paper, that the law has to be fair to you, it doesn't.
Okay.
If you, as it was once put to me by a very senior judge, actually, if you want the benefits of the club, you have to join the club.
I like that.
If you want the court to be fair to you on divorce, you've got to get married in the first place. And if you don't, you might own property together, you might have pensions, but there's very little you can do. Even if there's children, there's not much you can do.
Not. And that, it is still a myth. You still do have inquiries that will be living together 20 years. So it must, the starting point must be equality. And if you're married, it's not. And it's under reform. We hope one day the legislation will change. But it's a trickier area.
I've been talking about it for years and nothing has changed.
Yeah, and I'm so glad you've said it, because I think it is important to raise awareness around it until the law changes. Because I know plenty of friends who are not married, who have children, who didn't particularly want to engage in the institution of marriage. But I think that information does change things. If you want to be in the club, you got to join it.
Well, the benefits of the club, you've got to join the club. Exactly.
Great. So, and I love the idea of fairness, and now I understand full and frank disclosure. So let's talk about conflict, because we have you in the room, Max, and you're a barrister. So there is invariably going to be some element of conflict, unfortunately. So what role do solicitors and barristers play in helping couples negotiate effectively and avoid unnecessary conflict?
There are different kinds of conflict. There is conflict that just naturally exists between two people. And there's not a great deal. You know, if you have had an affair or something terrible has gone wrong, you can't prevent somebody from feeling angry about it. There is conflict which is produced when the proceedings go badly or they're mismanaged. And if you go to firms other than Raydens who don't serve you as well and who aren't as straight with you or as productive or proactive with you, why have I got to wait all this time? Why have I got to give all of these bank statements? Why is this costing so much? And you get that level of aggression. But the big issue at the moment in our world, though, is the serious domestic abuse and where that is there. And where that is present, there are some really clear parameters and protocols that we have to follow. I mean, we are set up to deal with it. Beanie, when you go and see a solicitor, I'm sure we'll be able to tell you in a minute what she does when the client walks in to see her. But if you come into court now, then, and there have been allegations of perhaps violence or things like that, you can have screens set up so that you don't see each other. So you can be in the same courtroom in the same hearing in front of a judge, but you can't see each other. Separate entrances, separate exits. And these things are written into the court orders themselves, yep, that they say, you know, that they mustn't come into contact. They must not have anything which sort of causes any friction between the two of them. But I think we're used to dealing with conflict. And what's, I think the challenge for us as lawyers is to remember that even if we've seen it all before, this is the only time this client will be going through it. And so we have to constantly be reminding ourselves to pay attention to their emotional state, because that's partly what they're paying us for.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are huge, high conflict cases. Mm. Inevitably, we are involved in a lot of high conflict cases. And as my role as a solicitor is to try and reduce that temperature as much as possible, because they will be angry if something's happened or if there's issues regarding children or one parent wants to move away, etc. And I think over time, we've noticed that actually letters, correspondence to other solicitors' firms, which are highly inflammatory, are just completely unhelpful. It doesn't help your client. It doesn't help the other. It just increases the temperature. And there has been quite a lot of focus on that type of correspondence, because if you have that level to start with, hopefully it will continue like that. You do need to remind either the other side, your opponents, that actually we need to keep this temperature low. Both parties will spend hundreds of thousands of pounds. And we ultimately, if they're looking to discuss the arrangement of the children or there's one family home, we need to keep those conversations constructive so they both get a good outcome.
Great. That's brilliant to hear. And what happens in the worst case? What when negotiations fail? What are the options?
So if negotiations fail or there is some other reason that you need to litigate, then a very clear process kicks in. You make an application to a court. You go through this process of full and frank disclosure. You then, when you get to the court for the first time, what's called a first appointment, unimaginatively named, the judge's job is, it's kind of a bit like a triage exercise. Okay, well, what kind of case have we got here? You've given me the disclosure. Do we need any expert help from pension people, or do we need some mortgage information? Do we need stuff from other third parties? Are there companies involved? Are there, you know, what kind of things do we need to do? So the judge will then make an order and set out what needs to happen. But the next stage, once all that information is in, is possibly the most helpful of all of the court hearings. It's called a financial dispute resolution appointment, or it's known as an FDR. And the judge at the FDR says, all right, I've got all the information now that was ordered at the last hearing. I've got your Form E. I've got your pension stuff. So what I'm going to do, says the judge, is I'm going to tell you what's likely to happen if you go all the way and have a trial. And if you go all the way and have a trial, the answer's going to be X, Y, Z. Now, go out into the corridor, go outside, get a cup of tea, and see whether you can sort out your problem while you're there. And 95% of people, when they get to the FDR and they hear from a judge, well, here's what happens if I fight, they will say to themselves, well, then why would I bother fighting? I know what's going to happen. There are times, however, when even that doesn't work. If there's genuinely something complicated going on, if they're telling very different stories about the history of something, or for some reason there's some genuine legal complexity, then fine, it justifies going to trial. Or, frankly, if they just hate each other, they will find they'll be going to trial because they don't want to do that deal, even under pressure from the judge. And if the FDR doesn't work, and as I say, 95, probably more, 98% of cases will have settled by the end of the FDR. then you go to a trial with witnesses and cross-examination and judgments and people like me standing up talking for hours. And there is more litigation than there should be because people should take more of an effort to avoid it. But once you're in the process, as I say, there's a real heavy pressure to settle it and get out of it. Because all it means is that the cases that genuinely do need to get heard are being delayed by the, frankly, the rubbish that doesn't need to be heard.
And you've been to so many cases. You've represented husbands and wives and also sit as a FDR judge. So you see it both ways.
Mm.
So you're when we have these early conferences with clients, actually Max can come in and look at it from a judge's point of view. And so you're in a good place to give us.
But it's in a weird kind of way because barristers don't get to know the clients in the same way. They can be much more objective in exactly the same way as a surgeon. You'll meet them for 20 minutes. They'll tell you either good news or bad news, then shift you back out again. Being nice and friendly is a benefit, but is a positive, but that's not really why they're there. Cool-headed, clear advice to people is incredibly valuable. And sometimes I get it wrong, and although Beanie doesn't, sometimes solicitors get it wrong. But having two heads thinking about the same problem, it's always better.
It's nice. We bounce ideas off each other, and it works.
It does work.
Brilliant. And all the thing that I really like about it is all to a positive, constructive end, which is in everybody's best interests.
That's it. Because the thing to remember, if anybody listening is involved in proceedings, then the one thing to, and they're thinking about making an allegation about something, the one thing to remember, best advice I give my clients, is that judges who deal with family law cases deal with the whole range of family law, from what I do, which is complicated assets that end up in tax havens in the middle of nowhere at one end, to the physical abuse of children at the other end. They see the whole range. And so there, the judge's sense of what a bad person looks like is very different to the average person's on the street. And so when they come in, and I've had this, I'm sure Beanie's had this, and a client sits down and you say, what's up? How can I help you? And they say, my spouse is a monster. What do? They refuse to do the dishes. Or, he slept with, my mate's cousin. You're like, okay, that must be very difficult for you, particularly the dishes. But that's not going to get much traction. And hearing that and delivering that news early is really important.
Yeah. And letting the clarity of the law speak for itself.
Correct.
Yeah. And before you go further, I mean, I've come here before and I've always said, it's so important just to have that first meeting with a solicitor, just to find out your options, even if you're not going to take it any further. And also having a conference with a barrister at a very early stage to know where settlement could potentially lie before you even explore any applications or have any discussions. It's so important to have that discussion, and then you can find out really where things may be going and then make the informed decision.
I agree.
Brilliant. Brilliant. So we touched on probably one of the most contentious issues, which is the finances. And then the next, or probably even more contentious issue is children. So let's talk a little bit about that situation. And for parents who are struggling to agree on arrangements, what options are available to help them reach a child-focused solution? And I know, again, I've learned from Raidens that putting the child at the centre of the solution is crucial. And you do everything you can to keep it that way.
Of course, in the absence of any safeguarding issues, we would hope that parents can manage the arrangements directly between them. And if not, we'd always suggest mediation, the collaborative law process. And if that fails, then you are looking at a process which involves the court. And again, making an application and asking a judge to consider, or specialists to come in and give their advice about what the best arrangements for the children ultimately are.
Mm. And it's difficult because arguments about children and arguments about money often happen at the same time, which is the worst thing for everybody. But actually, arguments about children and arguments about money are different. Mm. They're very different things. The big thing, Beanie does much more children work than I do. I used to do some a while ago. But the big thing to remember is that the way English law looks at it is that it's not the parents that have the rights. Parents have responsibilities, not rights. Children have rights, but parents have responsibilities. And what the court is doing is it only really wants to get involved if somebody is not using that responsibility properly or is not living up to what they should be doing. And that might be not promoting time that the kid should be having with the other parent. It might be not being reasonable about school choices. It might also be something serious in terms of abuse or that kind of thing. But actually, disputes about how much time a child should spend with each of its parents are really actually legally about how these parents should be doing the responsible thing for their children, because children need to speak both of their parents. And they need peace and quiet and calm when they're doing that. And a terrible solicitor will make that infinitely worse. Because once you can't, there's a lovely expression that we use sometimes in law, you can't unring a bell, right? Once you've hit that bell and you've made that sound, it doesn't go away. So once you've got a snotty letter from a bad solicitor, once someone said something terrible, that resonates for a long time. And it's a real, real problem.
Yeah, potential to cause a lot of damage.
Yeah.
And if parents can't agree on child arrangements, what happens next? Is court inevitable?
No.
Well, it doesn't have to be. We would hope that they stay out the court system. It's an emotional, difficult process. If you've got financial matters alongside it, it's something you don't want to get into. It's only if there are serious issues and someone is very concerned or a parent is going to take the child and go off and live somewhere else where you need the court's assistance. The court is there to help. And ultimately, it's a good forum to have because there will be some parents that just do not abide by any agreement between the other parent. And a court order needs to be in place to say that if you don't abide by that, you're in breach of a court order. And that has its own consequences.
No, I agree. I mean, again, from a litigation perspective, a lot of the cases about children aren't really about legal questions at all. So you're asking a legal process to solve a non-legal problem, which causes a mismatch. And if what's really going on is, oh, well, because he ran off with the local barmaid, he can only see the children once a week, and had he not done it, it would have been three times a week. Judge isn't going to help you with that problem.
No,
judge can just simply say, no, this is what's going to happen, but that's not going to solve the underlying problem. So the one piece of advice, if I had to give in relation to children, is to work out what the problem actually is and then solve the problem that's actually there, not try and translate it artificially into a legal dispute and then get some judge who can see straight through what you've done, ask them to resolve it. It's a waste of everybody's time, particularly the child's.
I completely agree. I
love, again, that you can say that the judge can see through these things.
Oh,
because I would imagine also there's a perception that he can't possibly or she can't possibly really understand the workings of relationships. But it's part of their job to kind of read between the lines and see through facades that people are trying to put up.
Not just that, but judges become judges after spending many years as lawyers. So they've been where Beanie sits and where I sit, and they've done that for 20 years, and they decided that it's all too exciting and they want something a bit less, where they can sit down a bit more, people come to them, and they become judges. But they don't forget the life that they've had, and they've got their own experiences. They'll have their own children. They'll have their own grandchildren. Perhaps you couldn't say this when I first started in the early 2000s, but now you can certainly say that almost every judge will understand the dynamics, will have seen hundreds of cases similar to this. I find judges are almost unshockable because they have seen, as I said, that whole broad range of stuff that they do. It's very hard to shock a judge.
Which isn't a great outcome, but it's probably because obviously it's a sign of how extreme things can get.
But what I mean by that is that they, when you go and see them, they understand that actually the problems that you're facing are probably solvable if you just approached it from a different way. But the only tools they've got, the only thing they can do is make an order. But sometimes actually what a child needs is not a court order, but mum and dad to stop arguing. That's what they need. And there's no, if they had a magic wand, that's what they would do. That's what they'd use it for.
And do judges, kind of in the same way, do they always get to the bottom of it? I mean, generally get to the bottom of it, hidden finances or complications in children's arrangements? Do you, for the most part?
I would say that if you leave aside the cost, which is a real problem, but if you leave aside the cost, it is an exceptionally accurate way of getting to the bottom of it.
Yes.
I am certain that I've had clients who have pulled the wool over my eyes in 25 years. It must have happened. But it's very rare for me to get to the end of a case. I'm sure I speak for Beanie as well, to get to the end of the case and to think, what the hell happened there?
Yeah.
Right? That's very rare.
Yeah. It's the finality and the closure for some parents and couples that are going through a divorce. It's just having that end result, an order in place, and then they can... It's ended. The
but again, getting to the bottom of it is not the same as a person feeling that they've been heard or understood or accepting a judgment. They're very different things, because sometimes people get so caught up in the way that they see it that they lose sight of the fact that, you know, they might be wrong. So, but I know, I find that judges nowadays are, you know, when you've had a trial and you've had the cross-examination, you've had all of that, and the judge has thought about it and given a judgment, it's very rare that you come out thinking, oh my God,
what happened
there? That's very rare.
Good. I mean, I think that's a great outcome, that there's an element of predictability
of course,
to
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
And I think you both paint such a constructive, positive, responsible picture of the legal system, which again will be really reassuring to our listeners. And there are, of course, alternatives to court. Can we just touch on them quickly, Binny, if you don't mind?
Yes. So there's mediation, where you could go in front of a mediator who will essentially look at the issues before him or her, and try and see whether there is an agreement that can be reached in respect to finances or children. Or there is the collaborative process, where I would sit with my client and the other party would sit with the collaborative lawyer, and there would be an agreement that they won't go to court as such. So there are those alternative of ways to avoiding court proceedings.
And they're much better. If you've got two people who are able to find their own solution, having given open, full and frank disclosure, that deal is much more likely to work. Mm. Also, not every problem faced by a couple is a legal problem. And if you haven't got a legal problem, you don't need a legal solution. So a mediator or a collaborative lawyer, which is a form of where you've got lawyers all working together, even representing different people, but all in the same room, working together, trying to collaborate on a problem. Much better, much better. If anybody comes to me as a barrister, that's a signal that something has gone wrong and my job is to fix it. I would much rather, I mean, don't hear my wife say that, hear me say this, but I would much rather far fewer people came to me. Because then I could concentrate on the cases that actually needed a proper legal analysis.
Brilliant. And before you go, you mentioned a magic wand. And actually, I'd love to ask you both, with your experience, Max, I'm going to start with you, 25 years, if you had a magic wand, what would you fix to just make the entire divorce process just a little bit better?
That's a really... really hard question.
It's a tricky one.
I've totally thrown a curveball at you. So
I think that if I genuinely had a magic wand, I would make solicitors, I don't include you in this, just to be clear. I would force solicitors to not just think twice, but think a third time about whether or not litigation is actually for them. because the problem is there's too many non-legal disputes clogging up the courts that stop the cases that really need a judicial attention being heard. So I would fill it out more to allow us to do a better job with the ones that really need it. That sounds a very technical, professional way of dealing with it.
Oh, it's so true.
Well, I think you're basically talking yourself out of a job, Max. So I don't think anybody's... Well, you're kind of saying, don't come to me unless you absolutely need to.
But again, think of it in terms of consultants and surgeons.
Yeah.
You know, people are always going to get diseases. But if everybody with the sniffles went to go and see a surgeon, they have less time to devote to the people that actually need the surgery. And that's the problem that we're facing.
Yes.
It's just a time problem. And, you know, I have really deserving clients who have got really genuinely complicated legal, financial, whatever it is, problems. And they're having to wait 6, 7, 8, 9 months to get in front of a judge when actually they need to be in there like in 2 weeks' time because it's really urgent. And that can't happen because there's all this non-legal stuff that isn't being solved because a lot of solicitors are scared of saying to their clients, actually, no. The right thing to do is not to tool up and try and, you know, kick your ex-spouse's head in. The right way of dealing with it is to try and sit down and negotiate with them. That's the problem.
Brilliant answer, Max. And I totally threw you on the spot. Sorry. Beanie, would you like magic wand too?
Completely echo what Max has said. And it is. It's from the outset reducing the temperature, and sensible lawyers will do that. There are occasions where you're... Could be the other person has instructed their solicitor to write in a particular way. But I think starting those discussions sensibly, amicably, goes a long way.
Brilliant. It's been so interesting talking to you both. Thanks so much for joining us on The Parent Show, Max and Vinny.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
And thanks so much to Max Lewis, who is a barrister, 29 Bedford Row Chambers, and Vinny Fagura, who is Associate Solicitor at Raiden Solicitors in St. Albans, who are indeed sponsors of The Parent Show.
The Parents Show on Mix 92.6, sponsored by Raiden Solicitors, award-winning specialist family lawyers. See raidensolicitors.co.uk.